From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Is it peace at last for Colombia? CCTV's Michelle Begay filed this report from Bogota about what may be the end of the world's longest-running conflict.
A historic moment from Colombia when President Juan Manuel Santos announced the definitive bilateral ceasefire between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels will begin this Monday, August 29th. President Juan Manuel Santos made this announcement from the steps of Congress, where he was taking a 297-page document, the peace deal that took 4 years to negotiate, to Congress. Congress will now take this document, read it over, and call for the referendum vote, which President Juan Manuel Santos said last night will take place on October 2nd. That's when all the Colombian people are going to go and vote either in favor or against this peace deal. Simultaneously, the FARC negotiators are traveling back from Havana to the Colombian jungle to show this peace deal now to their troops. And at the end of their conference, they are going to release a mandate where they finally officially declare the end of their war against this state. What we're waiting now is for the Colombian government to tell us when there will be an official ceremony for the signing of this peace deal, where we can expect a lot of heads of state from different parts of the world come together and watch this historic moment. The reactions around in Colombia have been heard worldwide. There are many people who are hopeful, very joyful of such a historic moment, but then there are those who are skeptical, who worry whether or not the FARC will keep the promises that they've made in this peace deal. And we are going to have to a little longer to see what the leader of the opposition, former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez, thinks about this peace deal. He said last night that he is going to analyze these 297 pages, as many other Colombians will do as well. But initially, he is calling Colombians not to vote in favor of this peace deal. And we will continue to bring you the latest on that. Michelle Begay, CCTV, Colombia.
Richard Becker of the Answer Coalition was a guest on the program The Debate on Press TV. When asked if he was optimistic about the possibilities for the ceasefire to hold, he said this.
Well, I think that it became clear over the years that even though the United States intervened heavily in Colombia, Colombia was the outside of the South Asia and the Middle East, the leading recipient of U.S. aid, which was designed really not for a drug war, but to crush the FARC, to crush the progressive movements in the country. But despite all of that, and despite great damage and huge casualties, it had become clear that neither side could really prevail, could completely prevail. And so after this protracted period of time, the leadership of the FARC and the Santos government decided to reach an agreement with the assistance of Cuba and Norway and other countries. But we have to remember what happened when there was another ceasefire in the 1980s, and when the FARC and other forces formed the Patriotic Union. And the Patriotic Union was an attempt to bring about a ceasefire, to end the armed conflict, and to have the forces that were involved in the popular movements and in the armed guerrilla movements enter the political arena. What happened between 1985 and about 1988 was that between 3,000 and 5,000 of those persons who transitioned into a political party called the Patriotic Union were murdered by the right wing and by the military, and that is what brought about an end to that ceasefire. The question is the same thing going to happen this time? And one of the reasons that there has to be very great concern is that the former extreme right-wing, I would say thug, president Álvaro Uribe is leading the campaign, the no campaign, because this agreement does not actually go into effect until a plebiscite is held in Colombia in which the Colombian people vote to support it. I think that there is no assurance really that Uribe And the right-wing death squads that he has been connected to for so many years will not try to destroy the agreement through continued violence against progressive left-wing and demobilizing guerrilla forces.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was in Reno, Nevada Thursday. She focused her entire speech on why American voters shouldn't vote for her Republican rival, Donald Trump, whose name she mentioned almost 50 times during the 30-minute speech.
Trump's lack of knowledge or experience. Trump is simply temperamentally unfit to be president of the United States.
Clinton called Trump the candidate of a new racist alternative right-wing movement.
Now, alt-right is short for alternative right. These are racist ideas, race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-women, all key tenets making up the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right.
Clinton also said that the world's leader of that movement is Russian President Vladimir Putin. RT's Gayan Chichikayan has more.
In the endorsement that Donald Trump received from the man behind Brexit, Nigel Farage, Hillary Clinton saw a Putin connection.
The grand godfather of this global brand of extreme nationalism is Russian President Vladimir Putin. And in fact, Farage regularly appears on Russian propaganda programs. Now he's standing on the same stage as the Republican nominee. Trump himself heaps praise on Putin and embraces pro-Russian policies.
Not clear what programs Hillary Clinton insultingly referred to, but Farage was interviewed a number of times by RT, which is funded by the Russian government but not controlled by it. If Farage's appearance on RT is Hillary Clinton's proof of Putin being the godfather of right-wing movements, then Putin must be the godfather of left-wing movements too. As RT repeatedly interviewed the left-wing leader of the British Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, anti-austerity former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who was against Brexit, by the way. Here in the U.S., RT interviewed Green Party nominee Jill Stein, former Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders. We extensively covered Occupy Wall Street, hardly a right-wing movement. The fact is, we covered many movements which, at their beginning, were hardly noticed by the mainstream media. Ahead of this presidential election, Hillary Clinton and her campaign have persistently tried to somehow link Donald Trump to the Russian president, to insinuate that Trump is disloyal to his country, to discredit him and his supporters. Earlier this week, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager went on one of the major networks and tried to discredit one of Trump's advisors, Michael Flynn, former head of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, by suggesting he has some inappropriate ties with the Russian government. His evidence? Michael Flynn was interviewed by RT and was invited to RT's anniversary in Moscow, where the Russian president was also a guest.
The gentleman he brought with him to his security briefing just last week is someone who's on the payroll of the Russia Times, which is basically a propaganda arm of the Kremlin. He was sitting two seats away from Vladimir Putin at their 10th anniversary gala.
For Robbie Mook's information, RT stands for Russia Today, not Russia Times. And Michael Flynn is not on RT's payroll. In an attempt to brand Clinton opponents as Kremlin agents, the Clinton campaign has shown little to no regard for facts and evidence.
Trump wasn't taking Clinton's statements lying down. Speaking in Manchester, New Hampshire, he said this.
So what does she do when she can't defend her record? That's right. She lies. He said it. She lies. And she smears. And she paints decent Americans, you, as racists. She bullies voters who only want a better future and tries to intimidate them out of voting for a change. I'm for change. She doesn't want change. Here's the central point that I want to get across today. Hillary Clinton isn't just attacking me. She's attacking all of the decent people of all backgrounds, doesn't matter, of all backgrounds, who support this incredible once in a lifetime movement. Never seen anything like it. We can't let that stand. We can't, remember. These are patriotic Americans of all backgrounds who want their jobs protected and their country kept safe. It's very simple. They want to have their country kept safe. To Hillary Clinton and her donors and advisors, pushing her to spread smears and her lies about decent people, I have three words. I want you to remember these three words. Shame on you. When you're like the Clintons getting 60, think of this one, getting $69 million in political contributions from Wall Street and big banks. And I think I got 16,000. You saw that. And I don't know who the poor guy is that gave me the money, because he's not going to get anything for it. It's easy to look down on the so-called little people. This is the way she views the people of our country.
Trump said that Clinton ran the State Department like a private hedge fund and detailed what he called a major criminal enterprise as he described the department's dealings with the Clinton Foundation. He also accused the former Secretary of State of perjury for hiding the 15,000 emails that were released this past week from the authorities, calling it Watergate all over again.
This has been a very historic week in American politics. The voters have always known that our leadership in Washington, D.C., is corrupt and that the system is very badly rigged, a word that I believe I used first that has been copied all over the place. It's badly rigged and it's broken. But this week, the curtain was truly lifted. The corruption was revealed for all to see. The veil was pulled back on a vast criminal enterprise run out of the State Department by Hillary Clinton. As the Associated Press documented, more than half of the meetings Hillary Clinton took as Secretary of State with people outside government were Clinton Foundation donors. Hillary's chief of staff received more messages from the Clinton Foundation's chief operating officer than just about anybody else. 85 donors alone that she met with as secretary gave the foundation $156 million. And I know many of these people. I know many of these people. These are not people that are going up to pay their respects and say, Madam Secretary, how are you feeling? Isn't it a beautiful day? The weather is so beautiful. These are people that want things for their donation. These are people that expect things for their donation. And when you follow it out and you see the people that left their office, you take a look at what those people, those companies, and those countries got. Believe me, you will find out it is plenty. On top of that, Bill Clinton's total speaking fees rose 44% while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, often raking in money from people who had business or matters before the State Department. Very simple. As I said weeks ago, Hillary Clinton ran the State Department like a personal hedge fund. It's hard to tell where the Clinton Foundation ends and where the State Department begins. Access and favors were sold for cash. It's called pay for play. Over and over and over, people who donated to the Clinton Foundation or who gave money to Bill Clinton got favorable treatment from Hillary Clinton's State Department. The examples are too many to name here in full. And I've gone over, I will tell you, I've looked at so many over recent days. But they include the deal to sell 20% of United States uranium to Russia. Or the very favorable treatment given to UBS, big bank, giant bank. It includes, we're all sick of it. It includes the exemption of telecom giant Ericsson from government sanctions. It includes efforts to put a foundation donor with no national security experience at all onto a highly sensitive national security panel that he wanted to be on with access to top secret information. It includes foundation donors getting lucrative contracts in Haiti, all while the people of Haiti suffered horribly and are not, by the way, big fans of the Clintons. But these examples are only the tip of the Clinton corruption iceberg. Hillary Clinton's actions constitute all of the elements of a major criminal enterprise. You know it, the government knows it, and she knows it. She created a private... She created a private illegal email server in order to hide her corrupt dealings. That's all it is, folks. Very simple. She knew what she was doing 100%. She did so knowing full well it would put American lives at risk by making classified information highly vulnerable to foreign hacking. And that's what happened. And by the way, people that did 2% of what she did, their lives have been destroyed. But she didn't care. As long as it helped her get away with her crime, no risk to America was too great. It didn't matter to her. And now she's running for president. Then, to further cover up her crime, she deleted 33,000 emails to keep them out of the hands of the authorities and the American public. As a further element of the criminal cover-up, she claimed, under penalty of perjury, that she turned over all of her work-related emails. We now know this to be one more massive Clinton lie and deception. The FBI found thousands of work-related emails she failed to turn over, including the new discovery this week of 15,000 more work-related emails she did not disclose. What is being uncovered now is one of the most shocking scandals in American political history. It's Watergate all over again. It's Watergate. And she's being totally protected by our government. A Secretary of State sold her office to corporations and foreign governments, betraying the public trust, putting innocent lives in danger, and then she went to great lengths to hide, delete, destroy, and lie about the evidence. Just like her lie that she never sent any material marked classified. Total lie. Lie after lie after lie.
Meanwhile, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein sat down with the editors at the Washington Post and took questions via Facebook. One person asked her via Facebook what she thought about NATO.
My view is that NATO needs to be part of a reexamination of our foreign policy. It's not just NATO, it's really the whole foreign policy, which is not working out so good for us. Look at these wars we've been involved in since 2001, you know, and some of that as U.S. forces and some of that as NATO forces, which unfortunately allow our government to do an end run around our national sovereignty. We get to decide when we go to war. Right now, half of our budget, more than half of our discretionary budget, is being spent on the military. Almost half of your income tax is being spent on the military.
So you would cut defense spending?
We would create a foreign policy based on international law and human rights. Right now, we've got a foreign policy based on economic and military domination. And this has been catastrophic. We've spent $6 trillion. When you include the ongoing health care costs of our wounded soldiers, we've created failed states, mass refugee migrations, and worse terrorist threats. Yes, we need to demilitarize our foreign policy, which enables us to cut these troops that we have all over the world, which are getting us into trouble all over the world, and making us bankrupt here at home. We need to ensure that we have true security by having the dollars that we need. You know, it's 54% of our budget that's being spent on the military. Do you know what the next biggest line item is in our budget? Once you go from 54% on the military, you come down to 7% that gets spent on things like housing and on administration and education and things of that sort. So this is absolutely nuts that we basically have a military budget with just a few little footnotes around it. This is not working for America. It's also not working for global peace and international security, because with each turn of the cycle of violence, we haven't stop terrorism. We've just created a new and more powerful form of terrorism. We call for a weapons embargo, for freezing the funding of those countries that continue to support terrorism, and for stopping the flow of militias across borders to create these international jihadi movements. So we say, you know, you can't both fight terrorism while we and our allies continue to fund it and to arm it and to train it. We've got to stop this. We helped it get started. We've got to shut it down.
Stein was also asked about international trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP.
Do you think the TPP is necessary? And if not, what would you replace it with?
No, the TPP is really not very much about reducing tariffs and improving trade. It's about boosting corporate power for these multinational corporations that get to put us on trial. They get to put our laws and our regulations on trial to see if their corporate profits are in any way reduced because we're protecting our health, or because we're protecting workers' rights, or the environment, or because we want green energy. If we compromise the profits of the fossil fuel industry under the TPP, they can sue us for their loss of profits. This is absolutely outrageous what's going on with the TPP. It's really important to stop it and work with us in order to stop it. And instead, we can have fair trade agreements that protect workers, that protect our environment, that protect national sovereignty. So let's work together to make sure that that happens.
Do you have a model of any such agreement that you look to that you think that we should be pursuing?
Not offhand, but I can tell you, unfortunately, the modern agreements, starting with NAFTA and many of these other world trade agreements, have created this global economic elite, which is making out like bandits, while working people all around the world are really struggling to survive. So it's very important that we work together to turn this around.
Nearly 2,000 lives, according to the official count, were lost to Hurricane Katrina 11 years ago this month, and city officials unofficially acknowledge that many more lives were lost during and after the disaster. The response to the disaster was one of the most shameful acts of a government with a rather formidable history of shameful acts, including genocide and slavery, to name two. Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford marked the passing of the anniversary with this commentary.
11 years ago this week, Hurricane Katrina flooded 80% of New Orleans, killing at least 1,200 people, although no one will ever know the actual death toll because most of the victims were black and poor and therefore were never considered important enough to count. What was important to the rulers of this country in the aftermath of Katrina was making sure that as many as possible of the displaced black residents would not be allowed to return to the city. Before the waters had fully subsided, corporate planners were exulting in the opportunity to build a new New Orleans, a much whiter and richer metropolis. Katrina had ethnically cleansed the city, permanently exiling 100,000 blacks, and the lords of capital could not contain their jubilation. What blacks experienced as catastrophe was celebrated as a renaissance. Katrina was a godsend for disaster capitalism and provided a model for capitalists to create future disasters for black people. President Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, said Katrina was the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans because it allowed school privatizers to fire all of the city's teachers, 71% of them black, and turn most of the schools into charters. Instead of firing Duncan for his outrageously callous and deeply racist remarks, President Obama joined in praising the so-called recovery of a city that had shed about a third of its black population and was on the way to becoming the nation's first all-charter school system. Over the next several years, Obama's Race to the Top program would coerce states to create a market for charter schools or face the loss of federal education funds. Katrina paved the way to a catastrophe for public education nationwide. During the last weeks of the summer of 2005, when the magnitude of the disaster became apparent, it seemed that almost every black community organization responded with some kind of Katrina support program. But there was no political response from the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington. The Democratic Party hoped to regain control of the House of Representatives in the 2006 elections, and Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi didn't want the party to appear too pro-black. She ordered her members to boycott the Republicans' hearings on Katrina, and Democrats held no hearings of their own. In the face of what was then the greatest black catastrophe of the 21st century, the Congressional Black Caucus allowed itself to be muzzled. The black political class's abject failure to respond to Katrina guaranteed that there would be more catastrophes for black folks. The Lords of Capital realized that if they could get away with massive ethnic cleansing in New Orleans while the whole world was watching, they could ratchet up the speed of gentrification and black removal all across the country. Soon, half of the black citizens of Michigan were disenfranchised by an emergency financial manager regime that took over all of the state's heavily black cities. The New Orleans model has gone national because the rulers of this country know that they don't need a storm to drive black folks from the cities, and that there will be no resistance from a selfish, useless black misleadership class. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.